You know, the scripture says that Satan is prince and power of the air, but if you work in audiovisual, he's prince and power of the air waves. And he'll get into anything electronic and he'll mess it all up and something will happen. So let's see that we don't do this, particularly with the creation science message. It's really, oh, I can see that. We'll make sure it stays in there. Cool. That this is a really important message. Well, anyway, you probably know that my ministry that I work for is actually headquartered in Dallas, Texas. And they have 53 or 54 employees there. And one gets to live outside of Dallas. And that's me. And it's a real blessing that I get to do that. And they are convinced that I'm living in Siberia. And I have to go down to Dallas several times a year. And every time I go down, they always say, you know, kind of a little southern drawl, aren't you glad to get down here? And I, you know, really humbly say, oh, yeah, I'm so happy. I'm so happy to get down here as I go from my air-conditioned car to my air-conditioned building back to my air-conditioned car. And nobody down there ever goes outside. I don't know if you ever noticed that. They never go outside. So I guess if we keep people thinking that we live in Siberia or something, then all of those people from Texas won't be flooding up here and congesting our roads. Well, anyway, how did I get here? Actually, I live in Rapid City, but I grew up in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Cheyenne. So I'm actually Wyoming. My wife was born in Rapid City, and when she was 1 year old, she moved to Casper, Wyoming. And she grew up there and moved to Cheyenne when she was in the eighth grade. And so we were in a couple classes together in high school. I went to a high school, a junior high called McCormick down there in Cheyenne, and then we went to Cheyenne Central High School. We used to have a good football team when I played, but anyway, I noticed they've been getting stomped recently in the last several years, and we didn't know each other at all until the senior high school. That's because we were in just completely different worlds. I hung out with football players and wrestlers, and she hung out with smart people in school. And so it was just very, very different. Well, how did I get here today? Well, I did not grow up in a Christian home. I had very good parents, very delightful parents, but not believers and still not believers, and never took me to church. And when I say never, I mean never. I didn't even go on visit on Easter. I didn't visit on Christmas. I just never went. And I believed in God, but he was really never, ever in my thoughts, ever in my thoughts at all. And all of that changed in the last trimester of high school. And I was taking a class. I wasn't even getting credit for it, but I was taking a class every lunch period, because I was a wood shop junkie. And I do remember that. They used to have wood shop way back then, and they had a shop full of tools. And I was just addicted to wood shop. So even when I wasn't getting credit, I would go to wood shop over lunch, every day, all the time. So I never went to lunch. And then in the last trimester, they just no class over lunch at all. So I had to do something that I didn't usually do, and that was go to lunch. And so I went to lunch for the first time, and I'm going through the line, and they have a tray. You remember, you have a little tray, and they plop things in little spots on the tray. I look and realize I haven't been missing much for the last 4 or 5 years, but it was good. And you know, Cheyenne Central's rather large high school. I think about 1,500 students when I was there. And we had a big commons area with a lot of tables, just like you guys have here. And so I'm a young guy, and I look out and see all the students eating, and what am I looking for? I know I'm looking for a place to sit, but more specifically, what am I looking for? Okay, I'll give you a clue. I'm a young guy, and I'm looking for a girl. That's right, I'm looking for a girl. Of course, I'm in high school. I mean, all the guys are looking for a girl in high school, right? Unless you're looking for something here, but that's it. So I'm looking for a young gal. Oh, I think it just needs to be plugged here. It's when it got flipped loosened him up here a little bit. All right, cool. All right, so it should come back here. There you go. All right, so, and I spied a gal that over off to my right, and I thought, wow, she looks nice. I think I'll go sit down next to her. So I went down, I sat down, and I started talking with her and joking and teasing and talking and teasing and joking. And what's that called? Flirting. There you go. It's coming back. Yeah, it's from way back. It's called flirting. Flirting on that. Maybe guys should do it more, you know. So I started flirting with her. And the gals probably already know this, but I'll let the secret out. Flirting is never a purposeless activity. There's always a goal at the end of the flirting. And now you don't flirt in vain. You flirt with a purpose. Isn't that right, guys? I mean, you flirt with a purpose. So the purpose is always to get the gal to say yes. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what you ask her. You just want her to say yes. So I could ask her this, yes, yes, yes. So I called her up and I asked her, this was in 1977, would you like to go roller skating with me on Friday night? Now, people don't roller skate like they used to. But roller skating was a cool activity. And, you know, for young people, it's a shoe with wheels on the bottom of it that you could go around. And what was good about roller skating is if she says yes, then you get to hold hands as you go roller skating around. Well, this gal had just become a Christian about 6 months before I called her up. And her Sunday school teacher had told her, you should really only date Christians. Well, she didn't know if I was a Christian, and she didn't know any tests for that. So she kind of put a little test out to see if I was a Christian or not. And she said, well, I'll go roller skating with you on Friday if you come to church with me on Sunday. And she thought if I said yes, that was because I was a Christian. I said yes, not because I was a Christian, but because I thought, like, wow, guaranteed second date. You know, it's like, you blow it on Friday, I'll recover on Sunday. So I said, yeah, I'll go to church. And I didn't go to church, but I knew they didn't hurt you in church, so I'll go to church with her. Well, I went to church, and she went to the Berean Fundamental Church in Cheyenne. And they preached the gospel. And it went in one ear and out the other. It just meant nothing to me. But I still liked her, so I called her up again. And I said, would you like to get pizza with me on Friday night? And she said, I'll get pizza with you if you come to church with me on Sunday. So I said, sure, I'll make that bargain. And so I took her out for pizza, and we had a really good time. I drove her home, parked in front of her house, turned the car off, and she looked at me real serious, and she said, Randy, there's something I need to tell you. And I'm thinking, ah, best guy she's ever dated, best time she's ever had, you know, just something about with the word best in it. And she said, Randy, you're going to hell. I thought, what in the world? I'm going to hell? I've had a bad date, but it never merited hell before. That's a bad one. I looked at her and I said, what do you mean I'm going to hell? And she said, well, Randy, you're a sinner. I can't tell you how offended I was at that. I was really offended. And not only was I offended, I was upset. And I looked at her and I said, I'm not a sinner. Sinners are in prison. And she said, no, you're a sinner. And I tried to defend myself. No, I obey my parents. I obey the law. I obey my teachers. I work hard in school. The key word being what? I. And she said, well, you may be pretty good compared to other people. And then, I don't know where this came from. She said, but do you have the righteousness of Christ? Where did that come from? I mean, who's got the righteousness of Christ but Christ? I said, no. And she said, well, you need the righteousness of Christ. How do you get that? And then she proceeded to tell me, oh, he died for my sins. My sins were given to him. His righteousness will be given to me. And you know what I thought of that? That's crazy. That makes no sense at all. I mean, if you're going to get to heaven, you've got to you know, work for it, do something, earn that baby. And I continued to date her, and this flogging happened every date. I mean, this was like, this was something else. So I continued to go to church with her, and I continued to do this, and then of all things, graduated from high school, and for a graduation gift, she gave me this box, and I opened it up, and guess what was in it? A Bible. And it was like in front of all my friends. And then it was like, wow. And then she pulled it out of the box in front of everybody, and she said, look inside, I've highlighted verses. And, you know, one of the verses said, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And then a few pages over, for the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. And there's another verse over in the book of John. And the Lord said, truly, truly, I say unto you, he that hears my words and believes on him that sent me has everlasting life and will not come into condemnation, but is passed from death unto life. And I continued to read that, and a couple of months after I graduated from high school, the light went on. I realized, wow, Randy, you really are a sinner. You really think a lot of stuff that you shouldn't be thinking. You say a lot of stuff you shouldn't be saying. You look at a lot of stuff you shouldn't be looking at. And I realized that I was in a bad way if I was going to stand before that God. I got down on my knees and I said, Lord Jesus, please forgive me of my sins. Come into my life and be my Savior. And I kid you not, my life was changed, completely changed from that point on. And that's how I got here today, from Cheyenne to Gillette, via a lot of different ways along the way. All because one gal was bold enough and loving enough to tell me what I needed to hear, even when I didn't want to hear it. And you're probably wondering, whatever happened to that gal? At least half the class room here is wondering what happened to her. Well, she's sitting right over here because about a year later, I asked her, you know, would you like to marry me? And she said, yes. And this May, we had our 37th wedding anniversary. And so that's been a real blessing. And she still tells me, Randy? No, she doesn't say that. She still tells me what I need to hear on all those things. Well, I'll tell you one thing. I graduated from Cheyenne Central High School firmly, fully convinced that evolution was an absolute, total fact. My biology teacher, Mrs. Zumo, I don't even know if she's still alive down there in Cheyenne. She might be. She was an ardent evolutionist. She taught me that. I believed it. I believed everything that I was taught unquestionably. I'm here to tell you, you need to question. You need to be thinking about what's being taught in school, thinking about what's put on the National Geographic Channel, NOVA, and these other things. And you have to be able to have some answers for some of these very, very basic evolutionary assertions, which I never had. Never had at all. And some very, very basic geological assertions. And I went to South Dakota School of Mines. You know where that is, over in Rapid City. I was a mining engineer. Mining engineer. Guess where I could have been working? Or maybe not working. I don't know. I could have been right over here in Gillette on that. And hopefully I would have been retired by now. But anyway, And I never knew some basic questions to ask my professors in geology. I'm not talking about PhD level geology. Basic stuff that you see as you drive around here. You head over towards Rapid City and stuff that we need to learn about. And we'll cover those on Saturday morning. And tonight we're going to talk about how to talk with your friends. You're going to have some evolutionary friends. I'm going to step down here. Verse sec, so I can see a little bit. In just a few minutes, I'm going to take the rest of the time to tell you how to do this, but how do you talk with them in just a few minutes, exposing the fluff of evolution? Now, fluff is an acronym, and it's hopefully something that you'll be able to remember. I use it a lot. I'm going to be talking on the radio in a couple days. I guarantee you I'll use this exact same thing we're talking about tonight. Well, we need to talk with them very, very quickly. Babe, honey, do we have any of these little booklets? Okay, you'll have to take notes. I actually have a little booklet that we could give you, but I didn't bring it, so you're stuck. So you'll have to take notes tonight on that. Anyway, you're going to have some friends that are going to be like that. They're going to be doubting. They're going to be convinced that what they're taught in school is really, really true. Oh, man, ViewSonic. It's not your computer. At my last event, the audiovisual guy did something to my computer, and the little connector, he squished it. And so the connector is a little squishy. So it's not your computer. It's the squishy connector from a dear Christian brother who I wished hadn't touched it. But anyway, so F should be there. Focus the discussion. You have to do it really, really fast because we don't have a lot of time. L, a new phrase we'd like to work into our vocabulary, less than persuaded. And we will go over these again. So you don't have to write like a maniac here. Unobserved important events, failed mechanism for design, and freedom found in creation science. All of those things. Focus the discussion, less than persuaded, unobserved important events, and then failed mechanism and freedom. Those are the four things, those main ones right there. So first one off, focus the discussion. Oh, that's the booklet that we were going to bring. We didn't have it. Focus the discussion here because time is limited and you need to define new terms, and we're going to have you just use two reputable sources. Everything in tonight's talk is just going to be two of this, two of that. So first, from the National Association of Biology Teachers, which is the largest biological organization in the world, 12,000 members. So they ought to know something a little about biology. They say that the diversity of life on Earth is the outcome of evolution. Bingo. They nailed the debate right on tard. We're not talking about simply change. Now, there's this logical fallacy called equivocation, where you define something and then you change the definition. Or in the old lingo, it used to be called bait and what? Switch. Bait and switch. So they want to come out and say, well, evolution, all it means is change. All it means is change. We see change all the time. Some of you woke up this morning and you'll go to bed tonight and you'll look in the mirror and you'll say, good grief, have I changed today? Or something like that. Or you'll look at your old pictures and you'll say, man, I have really changed. All of us change. Not everybody believes in change. If the whole thing was just based on change, there would be no debate because things change. But there's a big debate over this. This is subject to debate. Is the diversity of life on Earth the result of evolution? Now, that's something more than change. A lot more than change. That is subject to debate, and that's something that we can really discuss. So, if someone asked me about the definition of evolution, I might say, the National Association of Biology Teachers says, evolution explains what? The diversity of life on Earth. Evolution is supposed to explain what? The diversity of life on Earth. Simple as that. Bang. We focus the discussion onto something that's really important and something that we really need to discuss there. Now, that's a pretty extraordinary claim. Everything, birds, bees, trees, everything had one common ancestor, and we can explain it from that? Boy, we should be looking for some pretty powerful evidence to do that. I don't know why. I think it's a combination of both the guy in Redding, California who did this, plus the church that I was already warned about, that if it's going to happen here, that it's going to happen. So I'll get off the stage again. All right. Okay. So the next thing is, what is science? Now, we all learned the definition of science in school. It's basically what the National Academy of Sciences says. Scientific investigators seek to understand natural phenomenon by observation and experimentation. That's what I was taught science was. That's what I based it on when I went to medical school, when I was an engineer, all of those things, scientific interpretations that account for them must be based on observation and experimentation. National Academy of Sciences, this is what science is really based on. So I would say, I hold that science is based on observation and testing. So we've defined two things, evolution and science. And that's all we need to define right off the bat. Okay, this is an interactive talk. And I need to divide the room up into two sides here so that you guys can interact with me. Pastor, you sat on the wrong side, Ms. King. So my wife is over here. So by definition, since that is my wife, this side of the room tonight, just for tonight, you guys can be the smart side. Okay? Smart side. You guys over here, by default, turn out to be the dumb side. Okay? Dumb side. Smart side, dumb side. Okay, smart side. Smart side. Evolution is supposed to explain what? Diversity of life. There you go. Remember, you guys are the what?
Smart side.
Smart side. That's right. Evolution explains the diversity of life on Earth. Okay, dumb side. Science is based on what? Look at that. You see that? Man, just bang. This was like reading in unison right over here. That was so good. Science is based on observation and testing. But you even said experimentation. You say that, I mean, they'll think you're really smart instead of just testing on that experimentation. Good. That's it. Well, that's because you were copying the National Academy of Sciences. But remember, they're evolutionists. All right. Okay. New phrase. Less than persuaded. This is a winner. This is a great phrase. It doesn't really start a fight on that. Does that gal in the picture look less than persuaded? I mean, yeah, she's less than persuaded. Somebody told her something, probably a guy, and she gave him that look. You know why? I know, because gals give guys this look all the time. This is like genetically programmed. I don't think guys can do that with their face, but women can do this a lot on that. You know, there's some of them are looking at me like, right now, why are you picking on us on that? Well, anyway, I look at her, I see a gal who's less than persuaded. Someone's probably flirting with her, and she's not buying it. Anyway, less than persuaded. We want to be a little skeptical ourselves. We want to be the ones who are less than persuaded. And we don't want to say, well, I just don't believe in evolution. I mean, I guarantee you, that's the first thing that everybody wants to say. I don't believe in evolution. And then they're going to say, well, I don't believe in creation. And then you've hit a logjam. You've gone nowhere. So we want to work this phrase out of our vocabulary, that I don't believe in evolution. Less than persuaded means that we have been listening to our teachers. We have been listening to National Geographic. We have been listening to NOVA. And I listen to those shows. I listen very carefully. We've been listening, but we're less than persuaded. And when you say that, you're not causing a fight. It means that you're willing to listen. How many of you are willing to listen? All of us are. And if you're willing to listen, maybe the person you're talking to will also be willing to listen. Besides, when someone says the word believe, that has this sometimes a connotation of being somewhat fanciful. You know, do you believe in Santa Claus? Do you believe in the Tooth Fairy? Do you believe in these things? Sometimes it has the idea of something that is irrational. So we want to work out, I don't believe in evolution. We don't want to be saying that. Evolution, if it's supposed to explain the diversity of life on Earth, therefore, it is not huge diversity within one type of creature. I can show you every biology textbook. I guarantee you, I could go to the biology textbook in high school classes in Gillette, and I would pull it open, and they would show as evidence for evolution lots of different kinds of dogs, or maybe they're going to use cats, or maybe they're going to use horses. They're going to pick one kind of creature, and they're going to show you big ones, small ones, hairless ones, hairy ones, all kinds of things. And they're going to say, see how these organisms can change over time? And then they're going to want you to extrapolate, mentally extrapolate, that it's changed from some other kind of creature to that. They don't tell you about this extrapolation business, but extrapolation is a total part of evolution. They might show you a finch with a big beak and a small beak and a medium-sized beak, and they're going to say, look at all these different beaks. Well, what I really want to know is not how you get different beak lengths. Where did the finch come from? Now, why don't you tell me where the finch came from? That would be a good explanation for evolution, not a variation in finch beak lengths, but where did the finch come from? And what about peppered moths, you know, light-colored moths, dark-colored moths, changing in their frequency? I need to find out where the moth came from. And similarities in body parts. They'll show you, you know, that a dog has got one bone in its upper arm, two bones in its lower arm, similar bones in its wrist and things like that, just like I have, and just like a bat has, and just like a whale has, similar types of bones. Well, first of all, I'd like to know where bones came from. That's a good, I mean, tell me where bones came from. You know, there's more information in making a bone than there is in the most complicated building on this planet. That's how complex bones are. Where did all the information come to make a bone? And then two, not only are they similar, but they're also very dissimilar. Where did the information come to make all these bones dissimilar? Where did the information come to make all of these things? You know, they don't explain those kind of important things. Bacteria becoming resistant to antibiotics. Well, please explain the origin of a bacteria. There's more information in one of those microscopic things on your body right now than the entire city of Gillette. Far more information. Waste management, traffic management, and all the things that the city here does, a bacteria does. On a microscopic scale, with tiny little motors and engines and things in it that spin at 250,000 revolutions per minute. I mean, just how do you explain this kind of stuff? And then while it's spinning, stops in a quarter turn and reverses direction. I mean, just incredible things. Little transportation mechanisms inside a bacteria where it lays down a railroad track, transport things around the cell, and picks the railroad track up behind it as it goes. I mean, just it's just incredible. So please explain where a bacteria came from, and then also why are they still the same after all this time? This is the principal evidence I guarantee you is in the textbooks that I was fully convinced of myself. Less than persuaded. I mean, there's always creatures that are really doubtful themselves because I've been listening very carefully and I get a lot of stories, speculation, and a lot of special effects these days where you can turn on Nova and you can see a dog or a wolf-like creature walk into the water and morph into a whale before your very eyes because of computer-generated graphics. And we think that. Unfortunately, there's a lot of gullible people who think, wow, that can actually happen. But I guarantee you, little children see that. It looks quite believable that this other mammal can actually do this. We've heard it in classrooms. We've seen it on television. I'm less than persuaded because they're supposed to be explaining the diversity of life on Earth, but they're really not. I'm less than persuaded. I mean, that's a skeptical newborn baby. I mean, can you imagine? I'm raising that kid for the rest of your life. You tell them to do something and they give you that look because evolution doesn't meet my criteria of science, which is based on observation and testing. Observation and testing. Okay, quiz time. Quiz time, we're moving right along here. Okay, smart side. Evolution is supposed to explain what? Diversity of life on Earth. All kinds of creatures. And if you really want to, you know, show them that you're really on top of it, from a universal common ancestor. From a what kind of common ancestor? Universal. Universal common ancestor. Do we believe in common ancestry? Do we hold the common ancestry? Of course we do. We all are descendants from Adam and Eve. They are the common ancestor for all humans. And there was a dog common ancestor. There was a horse common ancestor. But evolution says there was a universal common ancestor. So it explains the diversity of life on Earth from a universal common ancestor. Okay, dumb side. Science is based on?
Observation and testing.
Observation and testing. Really, really cool. All right, smart side. What phrase do we want to work out of our vocabulary?
I don't believe in
hey, that was pretty good. I mean, the smart side's living up to their name. Cool. That rarely happens. But anyway, okay, so they're working out, I don't believe in evolution. And what phrase are you working in? I am? Less than persuaded. Less than persuaded. You can use that all over the place on that. You know, there's going to be some politicians are going to come to this state someday. You can just listen. Oh, I'm less than persuaded. You know, it's a lot of stuff that they say. Okay, less than persuaded. I'm less than persuaded because of two unobserved important events. There's a lot, but let's just keep it to the two basic ones for evolution. One, an unobserved natural origin of life. Natural. You know what I mean by the word natural? That means there was no intervention by God. None. Zero. Nada. No intervention by God. It happens by totally natural processes. Totally natural processes. What are natural processes? Wind, gravity, sunlight, all of those kinds of things that are happening around here. Rain, you know, it's happening. All this stuff is happening, and they bring life into existence. The trouble is nobody saw it happen, but this is even more important. Nobody is close to duplicating it. Nobody's even close to duplicating it. Why? Since the pastor said nobody's in a hurry to go home, let's just use this as a little extra teaching session here that I normally don't, that I don't put in this talk. Okay, think back. Think back to your biology class. Nobody's going to tell you what life is. You know how I know? Because nobody knows what life is. All I know is you either have it or you don't. I'm not pointing to you. I know you have it or you don't. You have it or you don't. This chair, it doesn't have it. But you do. What is it? I don't know. But I know what living things do. Living things grow. Remember? Is this going back to biology? Living things reproduce. Living things metabolize. And living things adapt. Does that ring a bell from way, way back? I mean, not way, way back, ma'am, but just, I mean, just a couple of years ago. I mean, back. Okay, what does it mean to metabolize? Metabolize means you get energy. You bring in something and you convert it to energy. You bring it in, you convert it to energy. Do you know how much information it takes to get to basically eat plant material or something else and convert it to energy that's running your cells? It's a phenomenal process. Hundreds and hundreds of steps. All that stuff. And then you have to reproduce. Simple process or complex? Extraordinarily complex. Then you have to grow. And then you have to be able to adapt. So in order for someone, this is all extra, no additional charge tonight, to explain the origin of life, you have to come up and you have to explain the origin of all of these functions. And then which one of those functions comes first? Do you see what I'm saying? You know, you, in order to reproduce, you have to be able to get DNA, and you have to be able to copy the DNA, and you have to put copies of the DNA in your daughter's cells. But all of that takes energy to do it. Therefore, you have to be able to metabolize. But you just mentioned you need enzymes and stuff. Where's the information for the enzymes? It's contained in the DNA. Do you see what I'm saying? So did reproduction come first, or did metabolism come first? Nobody knows. And I mean, nobody knows. Do you know? I'm going to foot stomp this. Nobody knows. And I could go to Harvard University, and next year I am going to go to Harvard University, and we're going to do a conference. And I will stay at Harvard. Nobody knows. And do you know how many of those august professors at Harvard University are going to come up to me and say, I know? None. No, none of them would dare do that because they don't know. And nobody is even close to explaining it for all the reasons that I gave you. You have to explain all of those things. And so therefore, that's why you see a headline like this in 2011 from Scientific American, which says, psst, don't tell the creationists, but scientists don't have a clue of how life began. And he's reporting on a conference of world researchers who do nothing but research a natural origin of life. And none of them have a clue. Look what the first sentence says. Exactly 20 years ago, I wrote an article for Scientific American in draft form that had the headline above, but his editor squashed it. Squashed it. And now 20 years later, he's writing the same headline. And you know what I'm going to predict? 20 years from now, he could write the exact same headline. Because it is phenomenally complex. Okay. The second unobserved event. This is a little longer, so smart side, this one's for you. A mechanism with the ability to transform one creature into a fundamentally different kind of creature. You need a mechanism, a process, a mechanism. Somewhere out here, they're going to mine that coal, and it's going to go through a process, and it's going to be processed in some way. So that's what a mechanism is. It's a process that can change one creature into a fundamentally different kind of creature, something other than what it was, even over many, many generations. Nobody has ever been able to find that. Nobody's been able to find it. You get a lot of different kinds of dogs, but they're fundamentally the same kind of dog. I mean, how would you like to be that little dachshund right there? Look at the look on that face. I mean, that's terrible. And that big, slobbering, football player kind of a dog on the left. I mean, that's just incredible on that. They're all the same on that. Wow, that's hilarious. I'm with you. Okay. That's less than persuaded. Well, I'm less than persuaded by this headline, which came out on the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birthday. It's by a professor, Richard Lenski, who was University of Michigan. He's running the longest experiment on evolution in the world. It's been going for over 35 years. 35 years. And this is what the experiment is. You've heard of a bacteria called E. coli? It lives in your gut. They culture E. coli. They culture it for a day, and the very next day they take and they destroy 90% of those. They take 10% and they plate them and they culture them for a day. The next day, destroy 90%, take 10%, plate it, and culture it for a day. On and on and on for 35 years. And the bacteria have been reproducing, and by 2009, when this came out, they were up to 50,000 generations. Now they're up to 60,000 generations. 60,000, that's a lot of generations. 60,000 generations of E. coli, and this is evolution in action, a salute to Charles Darwin. I have no clue of why this is a salute to Charles Darwin, which is supposed to explain the diversity of life on Earth, because after 50,000 generations of E. coli, this bacteria is still what? E. coli. Instantly coli. I have no idea why this is a salute. You know, they find little changes within the E. coli. Well, of course they are, because they are able to reproduce and adapt and do what living things do. But what I want to see is it something different. In fact, I'd even like to see it a different species or something. But it isn't. It's faithfully reproducing after its kind, just like it's supposed to do for 50,000 generations. And do you know who wants this experiment to go until the Lord returns? I do. Because I'll make one of two predictions. If this experiment runs for another 35 years, it's still going to be E. coli, or it's going to have gone extinct through mutational meltdown. Because these things are building up mutations within themselves. And they're eventually going to hit a point where it's just going to go and crash. That's what I predict. So whether up to 50,000 or 500,000 generations, one of those two things is going to happen. Okay. Quiz time. All right. You guys are less than persuaded because of two unobserved important events. The second one was... That's right. Failed mechanism. That's right. That's paraphrasing me a little bit, but just you're right on target on that. One kind to a fundamentally different kind. That's what we want to see. We want to see different kinds of creatures. Okay, you guys are less than persuaded because nobody has ever found a natural origin of what? Life. Look how fast they got that. I mean, it was like bang. Almost in one, natural origin of life. They all said it at once on that. Incredible, incredible. Okay, I'm less than persuaded because of this. Failed mechanism of design. The key thing is, whether you're an evolutionist or a creationist, everybody sees that things look designed. Nobody, not even the most ardent evolutionist, is going to be crazy enough to say, oh, life doesn't look designed. Does it look designed? It looks phenomenally designed. Phenomenally designed. You're designed. Creatures are designed. I guarantee if you had an opportunity to just read some papers and see some things, you would see design. We're going to talk about it tomorrow night on this immune system. Design like crazy. But not only are you designed, but you're designed to work with other creatures. Thousands of different kinds of creatures. And those creatures work together. Everything looks like a huge kaleidoscope of design. So everybody sees it. The difference is, creationists, which I am, I say it looks designed because it was really designed. It looks designed because it really was. There was a real designer. And now why do I make that statement? Because I just make a blind leap of faith? Of course not. I guarantee you this. I'm an engineer. And everything that was designed by somebody there. And you know what's really powerful about this? I'll mention this tomorrow in the men's devotion, but I'll just put it out to you right now. This is such a good evidence for God's existence. Because every culture that has ever been on this planet, sophisticated cultures or less sophisticated cultures, every culture has people that make things. Every culture has people that make things. And everybody knows that things don't make themselves. Everybody knows it. And everybody knows that if I have this clicker in my hand, whether it's this clicker or a basket or a chair or a wheel or whatever it is, everybody knows that this thing had a real mind behind it. And I have the same features of this. Therefore, everybody is accountable to know that there was a creator because they look created. Whereas I say nature looks designed because it really was designed, evolutionists say it only looks like it was designed, but it's only an illusion. That's because they base their design on this equation. Evolution is based on mutations. Not just any mutations, but random genetic mutations. random genetic mutations coupled to a process called natural selection. Now, this is somewhat odd. And this is what I believed. So I believe something that was odd. I believe that all this diversity of life on Earth was based on genetic mutations. And yet, what we know from science is that you do not want mutations. You don't want them because they cause what? Diseases. They cause cancer. They hurt you. They hurt you. Yeah, and you can die from mutations. You can get a mutation that will kill you as a child. We don't want mutations. When you go to the dentist and they x-ray your teeth, what do they do? What do they do? They take a lead apron and they throw it across your lap. They throw it across your lap. Why? Because you don't want your gonads irradiated, right? That's exactly right. Nobody does, because it will damage your, what, do you remember this from biology? Your gametes, an egg or a sperm. They'll go through and bam, they'll damage the DNA. And so you don't want those mutations. So it's kind of odd that this random process, which generally destroys information, is supposedly the raw fuel for the entire diversity of life on Earth. It makes no sense. The only thing is that you hope that given enough time and given enough chances, some of those may be helpful. I mean, that's what you're hoping for. And then, so you try to beat the odds by saying billions of different creatures over billions of years have had enough of these that some of those had to be good. And it's led to the diversity of life on Earth. Whereas in real life, nobody ever designs this way. I might use a random number generator to get a product that I will use in the rest of a process, but I never design randomly. And then this one right here, oh, this is where some real brainwashing has come in. Natural selection. You know, all of you in the room probably believe in natural selection, because that's what you're taught. And it sounds so obvious. It sounds so obvious. And the comparison to man-made selection seems so obvious as well. But it's, neither one of those are obvious. What do they mean by natural selection? What did you learn in school? When you say natural selection, it's what? Survival of the fittest. In other words, you know, and I see commercials and stuff today where somebody does something dumb and they get wiped out and someone says, what? Natural selection in happen. You know, natural selection in action on that. It's Darwinian. Well, let's talk about this for a second. In natural selection, what is the selective event in their view? What is the selective event? Who said that? You did. Exactly. That's it. It's death. It's always death. It's death. You guys die, you guys live. So the selective event is always 100% of the time death. Something has to die and something has to live. So the selective event is always death. And that's why Darwin never referred to natural selection aside from the struggle for survival. Struggle for survival. So what it's saying is there's a competition here, and some of you live and some of you die, and those who die, your genes are taken out of the gene pool. Those who live, your genes are retained. And then you will have offspring. They will be struggling with each other. Some of them will live and some of them will die. And that's natural selection. And it's always supposed to be based on some of those things having fitter traits. Who defines fitness? What is fitness? Is fitness survival? Is fitness reproduction? Is fitness having offspring? Is fitness having offspring that live to survive, to reproduce? You know how I know nobody knows? Because nobody knows exactly what fitness is. Nobody knows exactly what fitness is. You know, you can't just limit it to survival, because if you survive and you have no children or no offspring, nothing gets passed on. But if they don't pass anything on, nothing gets passed on. So nobody knows exactly what fitness is in any particular situation. All you know is that you survived because you were the fittest, and we know you're the fittest because you survived. And so you're the fittest because you survived, and we know you survived because you're the fittest, and basically all it's saying is survivors survive and dyers die. You know, that's all it is. It's just saying something lived and something died. Okay, well, Darwin then made an analogy, and the analogy is bogus. He went over and he looked at breeders, plant breeders, pigeon breeders. We'll come out here out west, we'll say cattle breeders. Now, cattle breeders breed for specific traits. And how they do that is they select cattle to reproduce. But they're able to do that. They're able to do it because cattle breeders have a real brain. They have real intelligence. They can make real selections. If I were to say to you, chocolate or vanilla, you could make a real selection. Both. Okay, that's right. I mean, it's like both. But you have a brain. You can make a real selection. Breeders can make it. Darwin made the analogy to what they're doing, but the problem is he's relying on nature to select. Aha! Is that analogy equivalent? Does nature have a brain? No. Can it make real selections? No. It cannot. It cannot. But here's the key. When you ascribe nature the ability to select, you have just ascribed to nature a human-like or even a God-like capability, the ability to make a choice. In other words, you have projected onto nature that, and nature doesn't have it. Now, I mentioned this to Pastor. If I held up a big statue right now and I said, this statue can select your mate. This statue can select, even though you're looking at it and it's just a piece of plaster of Paris. But I'm telling you, it can select your mate. You would say that I am advocating what? Idolatry. Idolatry. You would immediately see it. I'm holding up a statue. I'm telling you it can select. And you would say, oh, that's idolatry. The difference is, instead of holding up a statue, I just hold up nature. Nature. And I say, nature can select. Nature selects between the winners and the losers. Nature favors. Nature disfavors. Ever heard those words? You are favored by nature. You are disfavored. Selected. None of those things are real. None of that's real. Do you know where the selection event is happening? In their mind. There is no selection. It's only happening in their mind. It's not really real. So, the next time they say natural selection, just say, show me the selector. Well, you know, there is no real selector. It's just a figure of speech. It's just a metaphor. It's just an analogy. Well, you say, well, metaphors can't really design. They really can't design. This is really important. Very, very important. So this whole mechanism is silly. You're relying on something which destroys information coupled to a mysterious, mystical selection event. Nobody ever has a scientific paper where they show me nature is selecting at all. I'll tell you what's really happening. When I was an engineer, there would be a problem. And that's what engineers do. They're problem solvers. They come up with potential solutions for problems, don't they? Potential solutions. If I was the mining engineer at Gillette, there'd be some problem in the mine, and they'd want me to come up with a solution to that. I might come up with two or three solutions. This may not be a good example because my solutions always work. But if there were somebody else's solutions, maybe one of those solutions would work and two would not work. We would say one solution was successful and the other solutions were failures. That's all that's happening with creatures. You would never say the problem selected its solution. You see what I'm saying? That would make no sense. That's how it is in biology. Here's a problem out in nature. This creature solves the problem. This creature doesn't solve the problem. It's either a design success or it's a design failure. But what they do is they ascribe power to nature, saying, ah, it's selected for this one and it's selected against this one. Does that make sense? It's either a design success or design failure, but there's no selection event. Okay, we offer a more rational explanation for that. First, living things have features that conform to the patterns of design. Patterns of design. What do we mean by patterns? Well, let me give you an example. If you go out and you start your car, and you get out of the car, and you lift the hood, and you look at the engine running, you're going to see patterns of design. Patterns. What do you see when you look at that engine running? Think about it for a second. What you look at the engine, you immediately know the engine was designed. This is somewhat hard to do. This is a little exercise. What do you see in the engine that tells you it was designed?
Complex structure in order.
Perfect. You see complicated parts, and you said in order. Those parts are fitting together. They're working in together. And then you also, so there's several types of order. There's an order of how the parts fit together. Is there, who said that? You said in the back? Background. Is there an order in how they have to be put together?
Yes.
So there's an order in how they have to be put together. There's an order in how they fit together. How many parts? Few parts or a lot of parts? A lot of parts working together for a purpose. Do you see, since this gentleman knows engines, do you see precise timing? Fit. Did you say fit?
Yes.
Did you say fit and finish? Fit and finish, yes. Do those parts have, some of them have a prescribed finish?
Yes.
The inside of that cylinder, I guarantee you, has a prescribed finish. The rings, the pistons, where the crankshaft meets the connecting rods, all of those things. So we see multiple parts working together for a purpose with precise timing, precise order of assembly, precise fit and finish, and on and on and on, if we really wanted to go. Does your body have precise timing, precise order, fit and finish? It has all of those things. This is the key. Every time we see those things, they are always a hallmark of intelligence. Always. Natural forces, wind, rain, energy, sunlight, produces none of them. Zero. So, we have those patterns. The complexity is so high that the probability of them happening by chance is essentially zero. And how the complexity goes up with the more parts you have to get to work together. It goes up exponentially. And then on top of that, there's a lot of all or nothing unity, which means unless all of the key parts are there, nothing is going to work. All the key parts are there, nothing's going to work. Since you know engines in the back, is every part on an engine absolutely essential for it to run? Every part.
Pretty much,
but we could probably pull some parts off and get them to run. We could pull the air conditioner off and it would still work. I could pull off the power steering pump and it would still work. You see what I'm saying? I could get rid of some parts and it would still run. But there are some parts which are absolutely essential. And if that connecting rod is missing, nada. Crankshaft, nothing. So there are some parts that are essential. That's all or nothing unity. You have to have all those together. Living things have those. So I might say to my friend, when these two mechanisms are put to a head-to-head test, mutations and some mysterious selector coupled with all the things I just described, this is a much more reasonable explanation for the design we see in life. You see how I phrased it? It's much more reasonable. I didn't say you're a nut if you don't believe it. You know, I just said this is a reasonable explanation. It's much more plausible. And so I'm using those words, a head-to-head test. Now, this is just a gratuitous way for me to stick a picture of my son in my talk. Because this is my son here, number 30, dropping this crosstown rival dead in his tracks on the goal line. And just, I mean, it was just like a perfect hit. It was just something to see. You could hear it all over the stands. It was just kablam. And down he crumpled, just boom, he was gone, destroyed. And this picture was on the front page of the newspaper. So that was really, really good on that. He's now in the Navy on that. He's brain damaged, but no, he's not. He's not brain damaged. He's in the nuclear propulsion program on that. Anyway, he suffered a lot of concussions. Well. And then finally, freedom found in creation science. Let's end on a positive note. You know, this kind of freedom. Freedom just like, whoa, that's like free right there. Okay, I might even say, let me detail a few positive aspects here. First, the freedom to follow the evidence wherever it leads and never stop just questioning and discovering. All right, listen to this guy. He's an evolutionist. Scott Todd said in Nature, 1999, even if all the data point to an intelligent designer, such a hypothesis is excluded from science because it is not naturalistic. All we need is the top phrase. Even if all the data pointed to it, it's out. That's because the definition of science has been changed. You guys know that science is based on what? Observation and testing. Observation and testing. But now it's been changed to natural explanations only. Natural explanations only. Even if they're not totally supported by science and fact. But this makes no sense. I couldn't do that in medicine if all the evidence pointed to one disease and I say, well, I don't think you have it. You know, that doesn't make sense. You know, nobody does that in engineering. All the evidence points that this beam is not going to hold the roof, but, you know, I'm going to do it anyway. Nobody does that kind of stuff, except in evolutionary science. This is a man, Adam Rutherford, commenting on Guillermo Gonzalez, who is an astrophysicist who was denied tenure because he believes there's design. And this is what he said, saying whether in 4004 BC, that's pretty much my position, or 13 billion years ago, that was Guillermo Gonzalez's. He believed in an ancient universe, but he believed God made it. He said it's not falsifiable and therefore not science. I know that were in my position to offer Guillermo Gonzalez tenure, I would deny it for the precise reason that his, yes, religious views about purpose in the universe explicitly means that he is a doo-doo scientist regardless of his ability to generate valid data. That's very prejudiced. But I tell you this, that's not following the evidence wherever it leads. I like that freedom. Freedom from magical words. We just need to memorize one or two of these. Words like arose, emerged, appeared, gave rise to, a miracle of evolution. You know where I found every one of these words? In scientific journals and papers, which I read several of every day. Every one of these words is in there. You know what they are? You know they're magic? Because they cover up a bunch of missing data. The data, instead of it describing to me the process of how something arose, you just simply say, it arose. Arose. It emerged. It burst onto the scene. Here, I'm your doctor. here's some medicine. I'd like you to take it. It burst onto the scene this morning, you know? I mean, this is, nobody does that. Nobody does it. I wish all the kiddos in this room could memorize these words. Arose, emerged, burst onto the scene. I wish we had, when I was a kid, we had a thing called a clicker, a cricket. It was a piece of metal that you could squeeze in and went click, 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 click. If I would, I would have one of those. I'd print all these words on the back of it. I'd give it free to all the kids and say, "You listen. I want you to listen to National Geographic, one of their talks on evolution. I'd like you to listen to NOVA. And every time they use those words, you click this baby." And it's a contest between what? Smart side and dumb side. And you click this baby every time they use those words. It gets them to listen carefully to the show, and it shows how much magic is in those. If I could, I'd put it on a stamp and let them stamp their textbooks with it. And they wouldn't get charged for turning them in like that. And just stamp them, boom, 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 boom. And you could stamp scientific papers. I don't like these magical words. I never used them in medicine, didn't use them in engineering. Here's an example. Stuart Kaufman, 1995 at Home in the Universe. 4 billion years ago, some chondria of molecules danced, blindly catalyzing one another's formation, reaching a critical diversity at which self-sustaining webs of reactions emerged and formed life. Blind interactions gave rise to the emergent phenomenon of cellular life, cells linked in metabolic exchanges, blindly creating the first ecosystems. Those ecosystems have unfolded over billions of years with a profusion of species emerging and passing into extinction. At each level, we sense emergent lawfulness in the profusion. I mean, what? I guarantee you, the peer reviewers were not laughing when they passed this off. That's what I'm saying is a good example of that. Freedom that believes that all the design I see in living creatures is only an illusion. Richard Dawkins says, "Biology is the study of complicated things that have the appearance of having been designed for an illusion." He wrote a book blasting believers called The God Delusion. The God Delusion. His next book should be called The Self Delusion. I mean, that is something else. Co-discoverer of DNA, Francis Crick, said, "Biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved." Because it's shouting. It looks designed. It's designed. So this is what, you know, I wake up in the morning, you're a researcher, I smack you in the face until you say, "Okay, it wasn't designed." And then I say, "Now you smack me." You know, that's how it is, because it looks so designed. Well, that's really just kind of burying your head in the sand. You know, that is not really facing the evidence. And then finally, freedom from many religious conclusions masquerading as science. I'll just give you an example of two. This is the first one. Carl Sagan in his book, Cosmos, begins with this. "The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be." Now that kind of sounds a little sciencey. You know, the cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be on that. And it sounds, you know, he uses the word cosmos. The question is this. Dr. Sagan, and I would say it really respectfully, Dr. Sagan, what experiment did you do and what scientific paper did you publish it in that supports this conclusion? You know, don't argue. Just ask them, what experiment did you do? Do you realize you can't come up with an experiment to do this? The experiment would be going. It would be like this universal experiment. So is this really a scientific statement, or is it a religious statement that comes out of his mind that he's framed in scientific words? It's a religious statement. It's a religious statement. Here's another one. Michael Shermer, quoting Richard Dawkins in Scientific American, says, in one of the most existentially penetrating statements ever made by a scientist, Richard Dawkins concluded that the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. This is one of the most profound statements ever made by a scientist. That's what he says. Well, is that a scientific statement or a religious statement? I would say, Dr. Dawkins, what experiment did you do where you showed that there was no purpose in the universe? What paper did you publish where you showed there was no evil and no good, and on and on and on? How would anybody do an experiment on that? Concoct an experiment where you show there's no purpose. Come up with one that shows there's no evil. You see what I'm saying? I didn't hear that. Maybe I shouldn't have on that. Okay. On there. You see what I'm saying? Those are not religious. Those are not scientific statements. They're religious. I said, this was the last one. Let me throw you out one more. I got a bunch. Stephen Hawking. Ever heard of him? You know, supposedly one of the smartest men on the planet, says there is no heaven. Wait a second here. Stephen Hawking says there is no heaven. So I guarantee you there's some people will say, Stephen Hawking said it, I believe it. And this is what he said. The world-renowned theoretical physicist finds no room for heaven in his vision of the cosmos. The 69-year-old says, quote, there is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers. That's what he calls your brain. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. Now, Stephen Hawking should know that experimentation is important. I would say, Dr. Hawking, you said there's no heaven. What experiment did you do that demonstrated there was no heaven? And you know, this is a toughie, Dr. Hawkins, since you're still alive. You know, in order to demonstrate there's no heaven, that means you have to what? Die. And then you have to like, look, hey, there is no heaven. And then you come back and you tell somebody, there's no heaven. I died and I found out there's no heaven. But he didn't die. So he's just making a religious statement that sounds really sciencey. And I guarantee you these are flooding lots of things. Oh. Lawrence Krauss, he's another theoretical physicist at home. He has a book called A Universe from Nothing. This is a long quote, but you'll get the point. The amazing thing is that every atom in your body came from a star that exploded. And the atoms in your left hand probably came from a different star than your right hand. It is really the most poetic thing I know about physics. You are all stardust. You couldn't be here if stars hadn't exploded, because the elements, the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, and all the things that matter for evolution were created in the nuclear furnaces of stars, and the only way they could get into your body is if those stars were kind enough to explode. So forget Jesus. The stars died so that you could be here today. Wow. It is. And he's a full professor at Arizona State University. Yes.
He indoctrinates our children.
Teaches, indoctrinates. I think you meant the same thing. Same thing on that. And I guarantee you, the students who are in that lecture hall while he's saying this are not getting the chuckle that we are getting the chuckle. They're taking it down as notes. They're writing it down as facts. And we need to have these young people in this room inoculated in advance, so that when they go there and they listen to this guy, they don't laugh at him to his face, but they're laughing on the inside. They realize that this is just mumbo jumbo. It's just religious statements masquerading as science. And every now and then they could ask a pointed question. That's the key thing. You don't need to take down Lawrence Krauss. Invite one of us to come and take him down. Just ask him a question. Dr. Krauss, how do you know those things? Or something else. Just ask one of those questions. I wrote this down, but I didn't catch the paper that was published in. What paper was that published in? You know, you're something like that. So it sounds, so everybody realizes, well, that's not published in a paper, and so on and on. I could go on that. But we, if we only have 5 minutes to talk with our friends, we need to focus the discussion to find two things. Evolution explains the diversity of life on Earth, and science is based on observation and testing. We have been listening carefully to everything that people have been telling us, and we're less than persuaded. And I gave you a whole list of things that we're less than persuaded about, but two really important ones. An unobserved natural what? Origin of life, and a mechanism to change one creature into a fundamentally different kind. Those two things must happen if evolution is going to happen. I'm less than persuaded. Failed mechanism for design. We know the problems with mutations. They tear information down. We know the question to ask when they say natural selection. Show me the selector. And now you can explain why nature doesn't have a brain. It can't really select. It's not like a real human breeder, and on and on and on. We can explain those things to them. But on the other hand, living things, if nothing else, if you just remember the patterns of design, multiple parts working together for a purpose with precise timing, fit and fit, and all those things, fit and finish, and all those things. And then the freedom found in creation science. And even if you don't remember all of those, you remember the freedom to follow the evidence wherever it leads, and the freedom from religious statements masquerading as science, such as when Carl Sagan says, the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. And the question you need to ask them is, what experiment did you do? What paper was it published in? And you'll put them on the spot. And if you can explain those things with your friends, and just about as quickly as I did it with you, I guarantee you, you'll get them to begin to question some things, their worldview. And then the next thing you want to say, don't just leave them there, say, but if you have just another minute, I'd like to tell you who that designer is. That's the Lord Jesus Christ, and I'd like to introduce you to him. That's where you're going with this, is to point them to that, not just to knock down their belief, but to point them in the correct direction of where they need to go. Amen? Amen. Well, Pastor, that's it. Thank you guys for your patience.